The program scheduled to be heard at this time will not be presented. In its place, we bring you, direct from London, a talk by Sir George Clark, former British ambassador at Ankara, who will speak on the treaty just signed by Great Britain, France, and Turkey. He will be heard through the facilities of the British Broadcasting Corporation. We take you now to London.
1926 to 1933, and who therefore saw the development of modern Turkey, give some impressions of that country. To Sir George, as much as to any other Englishman, the present friendship between England and Turkey is due. Sir George Clark.
An envoy to a foreign state should, of course, always cultivate the friendship of the government and people to whom he is accredited. But it is even better if he finds a spontaneous liking for the people amongst whom he is to spend some of the most active and important years of his life. That was my case when I went to Ankara in 1926 as His Majesty's ambassador. It was a very different Turkey from the romantic Istanbul that I had known as a secretary in our embassy 16 years or so before. And I must admit that the situation was not altogether easy, either for the Turks or for myself. Memories of the Great War were still fresh, and the storm of opposing policies, though calmed down on the surface, had left a groundswell that one could at times hear growling underneath. But as soon as I came into contact with Mustafa Kemal, as he then was, and his armed helpers who were building up the new Turkey, I felt at once two great qualities of the Turk, loyalty and gratitude. I could see the Turkish sense of gratitude in their relations to Russia, who had been their friend when they stood almost alone in the world. And I could see their loyalty in their scrupulous observance of the Treaty of Mosul, over which my very old friend, the Foreign Minister, now I am glad to say Turkish Ambassador in London, and my predecessor, Sir Ronald Lindsay, had had many a hard-fought discussion. Mustafa Kemal, with that profound sagacity which distinguished him, realized that the greater end was peace and the development of the new Turkey. And once the treaty was signed, there has never been any thought of going back on it. Indeed, Turkey, since the Great War, has been a shining example of fidelity to her pledged word. A treaty signed by Turkey is a treaty that will be scrupulously kept. Therefore, I, for one, never wavered in my belief that the negotiations which have been going on between Turkey and France and ourselves would end in Thursday's agreement. That agreement, which has given such deep-seated satisfaction to this country and which has sealed our good relations with Turkey. I could only wish that that great man, Kemal Atatürk, was still with us to see this finish to his work of establishing true friendship with England. But I am glad to think that all his collaborators who have carried it on are sharing our satisfaction. They were a remarkable band of men, few in number, but fired by the dynamic energy of their leader, deterred by no difficulties, and resolute to build up the new Turkey on the lines designed by their leader. İsmet Paşa, now General İnönü, President of the Turkish Republic, Dr. Tevfik Aras, Mr. Fethi Okyar, lately ambassador here and now Minister of Justice in Ankara, and the other leading personalities with whom he worked, were all men of single mind and purpose. And together they brought about, in an amazingly short space of time, the complete regeneration of a war-ravished country, which, in many ways, had scarcely changed its manner of thought and life for over three centuries. When I first knew Turkey in 1910, although the Young Turk Revolution had brought a breath of liberalism into the traditions of Turkish life, almost the only outward visible sign of modern progress was the extinction of the famous dogs who for centuries had carried out the cleaning of the streets, which we see done here by the motorized rubbish carts and thigh-booted, shovel-headed functionaries of the borough councils. Galata Bridge was still a stream of motley, many-colored humanity. And under the walls of the Valide Mosque nearby, fresh butter and cheese were offered to the passerby by a venerable white-bearded Turk, with whom you could see his brother, the foreign minister of the Turkish Empire, chatting for a moment on his way to his office. If you were close enough, you might hear the foreign minister, in whose palace you might have dined the night before, in all the pomp of silver plate and powdered footmen and military bands. Say, how is it with you, my brother? And the cheese seller would reply, God be praised, better than with you, my brother. I have sufficient for my needs, and my life is peaceful and happy, whereas you know not from day to day how long your head may be upon your shoulders. When I returned 16 years later, that life, or nearly all of it, had gone. One of the great figures of history had come upon the Turkish stage. Rightly or wrongly, I have always held that Mustafa Kemal was by nature a thinker and historian rather than a soldier and a man of action. But when he was young, the army was almost the only and certainly the most promising road for advancement, and a soldier he became, and a very good one too. But it was the thinker in him that realized the paradox that it was Byzantium that had conquered Turkey on that fatal day in 1453, when Constantinople fell before the Ottoman assault, and Mohammed II rode his horse over the bodies of the slain up to the high altar of San Sophia. Mustafa Kemal knew that the secular pomp of the Sultan's court was little more than a continuation of Byzantine ceremony, and he knew further that he must remove the administration of the country from the soft, insidious airs of the Bosphorus to a more vigorous climate, if he was to train his people to face and overcome the difficulties which awaited the creation of a new and modern state. There were, of course, other considerations in his mind, strategic and economic. But, above all, he had to teach his people to work. And at Ankara, there was nothing to do except to work. And gradually, as I was privileged to see, though gradually is perhaps too mild a word, for the pace of the development was astounding, there emerged a modern state prepared to work out its own destiny and determined to live its own life, interfering with no one beyond its boundaries, but ready to defend its own liberties to the last. But it needed all the determination and forcefulness of Mustafa Kemal and the enthusiasm and energy of his devoted helpers to bring this about. Imagine what it means to a whole people to whom the fez has been for generations a symbol of their nationality, to be told, almost literally overnight, to abandon it and wear the convenient but unbeautiful hats and caps of the outside world. What the people at large could not see at first was that the fez stood for all that was retrograde and backward, for the domination of the mullah and the haji, for the stultification of the spirit of the country. I should say here that the abolition of the fez was not anti-religious. The Ghazi never interfered with the practice of true religion, Islam, Jew, or Christian. But it was to end the parasites who, like the monks and friars of the Middle Ages, battened on the ignorance and superstition of the people. There were a few recalcitrant spirits, but when the Ghazi, almost unattended, went himself to Samsun on the Black Sea, perhaps the most fanatical town in Turkey, and walked into the mosque wearing what is known as a bola, and faced the people with those terrifically commanding blue eyes of his, the opposition ended. Then again, Mustafa Kemal considered that unless his people knew the script used by the rest of the civilized world, they could never understand what that world meant and thought. So he summoned his professors and his newspaper editors, and he said, how long would it take to teach the people Latin script and print their books and papers in those characters? Some of the more progressive spirits thought that with hard work it might possibly be done in 2 years. Nonsense, said Mustafa Kemal. It's got to be done in 6 weeks. And in 6 weeks it was done. And of course, there was the great work carried out in the emancipation of women, though there, I am bound to say, the ground had, at all events among the well-to-do and better-educated Turks, been prepared in advance. Behind their veils, Turkish ladies were far more emancipated than was realized, and, except in some of the more remote villages in the Anatolian highlands, they were ready, and indeed glad, to put those veils aside. In very truth, in every phase of modern life, in education, town planning, expansion of railways, development of manufactures, improvements in farming, everything. Kemal Atatürk, with limited financial resources, without native experts, set up, somehow or other, by sheer genius and driving power, a modern state. Of his qualities as a soldier and leader and commander of men, I will give you an instance which Kemal Atatürk told me himself. During the Gallipoli campaign, Mustafa Kemal had had a difference of opinion, not in any sense a political one, but purely on military and professional grounds, with General Liman von Sanders, who was commanding the Turkish forces. General Mustafa Kemal had, in consequence, been relegated, as sometimes happens to subordinates who know better than their chiefs, to train a division at the base. One day, he had taken a regiment on a route march and had given them what I might call a real doing, and had then allowed them to rest for a few minutes in the shade, while he and his aide-de-camp rode up to the brow of a hill to look over and to see, if anything was to be seen, of what was happening in the fighting line. What he did see was Turkish soldiers running towards him, and shortly they came up to him. So he said, "My lambs, what are you doing?" And the soldiers said, "We're running away." He replied, "But Turkish soldiers don't run away." And the soldiers answered, "No, but we've got no ammunition to fight with, and the British are pursuing us." Mustafa Kemal said, "You've still got your bayonets?" They said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, hold on here for a few minutes and I'll bring you help." And he then galloped down the hill, brought up his regiment and deployed them just as the British came up the hill and turned our troops back. But for that, we should probably have taken command of those heights and might have finished the campaign. Of such incidents is history made. And lastly, with the exception of Cincinnatus, he is perhaps the only dictator who has been great enough to measure the terms of his dictatorship. When he had got his country started on the lines he laid down for it, he then withdrew from active participation in its administration. In effect, he said to his collaborators, "You people have got to learn the job of administration. You will make mistakes, of course, and if those mistakes are too glaring, I shall be here to correct them. But unless you do the work yourselves, you will never learn how to do it, nor how to train your successors. So get on with it, and let me get on with what I really want to do, which is to study the origin of the Turkish race." If I seem to have dwelt overmuch on the individual rather than on the people as a whole, it is because if ever the rebuilding of a nation was the work of one man, it was so in the case of Kemal Atatürk. And I am sure that all those who helped him so loyally and so brilliantly will agree with this. I have tried to give you a brief picture of what this gigantic figure did and of the principles with which he inculcated his people. Principles which have led to the treaty which has just been signed and which ensures many years of mutual and, I am confident, fruitful collaboration between France and Turkey and ourselves.